NPR has created a few traditions of its own. During this next hour, some of NPR's best storytellers will share holiday tales that have become listener favorites, including some that you might not have heard in a while. They touch on the range of emotions all of us experience at this time of year, from wistfulness to joy, from doubt to hope. I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Tinsel Tales, Stories of the Christmas Season from NPR. For the child in many of us, the image of Christmas morning centers on that one perfect gift waiting under the tree. On one particular Christmas several years ago, all things considered, commentator Lee Stringer felt prepared to settle for something less than perfection.
I couldn't help feeling a certain eagerness when I woke up Christmas Day 1985, even though I was living under a staircase on the lower level of Grand Central Terminal in New York. Nothing like the holidays to bring out the little child inside. I had heard rumors that random acts of kindness had run rampant amongst last year's holiday travelers. So heck, I figured I wasn't so down on my luck that I couldn't give luck a fair chance. But when I stirred, I noticed my shoes were gone. Someone not content to wait on the hand of Providence had made a gift of them to himself, I supposed. I was hungry. I shook the sleep out of me and slap-footed my way upstairs. The concrete floors were cold, but not so rude as they might have been had my socks been stolen, too. It was early yet. The main floor was eerily deserted. There were two huge reeves above the departure gates twinkling away in the morning light, while the PA system spilled carols into the empty air. I made my way to the departure platforms, squeezed myself between the cars of an idling train, and slipped in through the end door. There was odd, festive litter everywhere, as if a happy riot had taken place. I rummaged around and managed to turn up a styrofoam cooler filled with iced beer, chicken, and pastry. I only gave a second's thought as to what had led someone to abandon it. I sat down, hoisted a toast to good fortune, ate and drank. Life is the damnedest thing, I told myself. Even in miserable circumstance, it finds a way to serve up its perks. I even began to see my stolen shoes as a good thing in a way. You see, my mother was expecting me for Christmas dinner. She lived about 45 miles north of New York in a small blue-collar kind of town, and I didn't want to go. My brother and father had both died last year. And the thought of sitting across that lonely table sent a shiver through my bones. I didn't like the idea of showing up empty-handed, either. Even in the season of giving, we reserve little glory for the givee. I called collect, told my mother I had no shoes, that there was no way I could make it. I lolled on the waiting room benches for a while, waiting, I suppose, upon a fresh act of fate to cover my feet, and I thought of my mother, who has bad eyes and bad knees and doesn't get around too well anymore. I pictured her sitting down to a lonely Christmas dinner, made lonelier still by my absence. And that drove me back to the phone. But there was no answer this time. I threaded my way back to the waiting room, past eager, wide-eyed children, past gift-laden travelers in thick winter coats, past lovers strolling hand in hand, and sat back down on the bench. The day unwound itself in loud silence. The din of the mounting crowd seemed strangely reserved, tamped down to a purr which soon lulled me into a brief doze. When I opened my eyes again, my mother was standing there. A pair of my old sneakers was in her hand. "Merry Christmas," she said.
Lee Stringer was homeless for 10 years. In 1998, he published a memoir called Grand Central Winter, Stories from the Street. He now lives in Mamaroneck, New York. In 2000 and 2001, writer Paul Auster gathered stories for a series on Weekend All Things Considered called the National Story Project. The stories came directly from listeners. This one, written by Sylvia Seymour Aiken of Memphis, Tennessee, is entitled Christmas Morning, 1949. It's read by Paul Auster.
A light drizzle was falling as my sister Jill and I ran out of the Methodist church, eager to get home and play with the presents that Santa had left for us and our baby sister, Sharon. Across the street from the church was a Pan-American gas station where the Greyhound bus stopped. It was closed for Christmas, but I noticed a family standing outside the locked door, huddled under the narrow overhang in an attempt to keep dry. I wondered briefly why they were there, but then forgot about them as I raced to keep up with Jill. Once we got home, there was barely time to enjoy our presents. We had to go off to our grandparents' house for our annual Christmas dinner. As we drove down the highway through town, I noticed that the family was still there, standing outside the closed gas station. My father was driving very slowly down the highway. The closer we got to the turnoff for my grandparents' house, the slower the car went. Suddenly, my father U-turned in the middle of the road and said, "I can't stand it." "What?" asked my mother. "It's those people back there at the Pan Am standing in the rain. They've got children. It's Christmas. I can't stand it." When my father pulled into the service station, I saw that there were five of them, the parents and three children, two girls and a small boy. My father rolled down his window. "Merry Christmas," he said. "Howdy," the man replied. He was very tall and had to stoop slightly to peer into the car. Jill, Sharon, and I stared at the children, and they stared back at us. "You waiting on the bus?" my father asked. The man said that they were. They were going to Birmingham, where he had a brother and prospects of a job. "Well, that bus isn't going to come along for several hours, and you're getting wet standing there. Windborne's just a couple miles up the road. They've got a shed with a cover there and some benches," my father said. "Why don't you all get in the car, and I'll run you up there." The man thought for a moment, and then he beckoned to his family. They climbed into the car. They had no luggage, only the clothes they were wearing. Once they were settled in, my father looked back over his shoulder and asked the children if Santa had found them yet. Three glum faces mutely gave him the answer. "Well, I didn't think so," my father said, winking at my mother, "because when I saw Santa this morning, he told me he was having trouble finding y'all, and he asked me if he could leave your toys at my house. We'll just go get them before I take you to the bus stop." All at once, the three children's faces lit up, and they began to bounce around in the back seat, laughing and chattering. When we got out of the car at our house, the three children ran through the front door and straight to the toys that were spread out under our Christmas tree. One of the girls spied Jill's doll and immediately hugged it to her breast. I remember that the little boy grabbed Sharon's ball, and the other girl picked up something of mine. All this happened a long time ago, but the memory of it remains clear. This was the Christmas when my sisters and I learned the joy of making others happy. My mother noticed that the middle child was wearing a short-sleeved dress, so she gave the girl Jill's only sweater to wear. My father invited them to join us at our grandparents' for Christmas dinner, but the parents refused. Even when we all tried to talk them into coming, they were firm in their decision. Back in the car, on the way to Windborne, my father asked the man if he had money for bus fare. His brother had sent tickets, the man said. My father reached into his pocket and pulled out $2, which was all he had left until his next payday. He pressed the money into the man's hand. The man tried to give it back, but my father insisted. "It'll be late when you get to Birmingham, and these children will be hungry before then. Take it. I've been broke before, and I know what it's like when you can't feed your family." We left them there at the bus stop in Windborne. As we drove away, I watched out the window as long as I could, looking back at the little girl hugging her new doll.
Paul Auster, reading Christmas Morning 1949 by Sylvia Seymour Agin. Auster included that piece in the National Story Project, which he curated for Weekend All Things Considered. That and other stories from the project are collected in a book called I Thought My Father Was God. You're listening to Tinsel Tales, Stories of the Season from NPR. Even at an extraordinary time of the year, like Christmas, it can be hard for the celebration to sustain its sparkle. Still, All Things Considered commentator Bailey White does her best to see that glass of eggnog as half full.
This time of year, there's an article in every women's fashion magazine about the Christmas office party. The photographs show beautiful women eating tiny food and drinking wonderful-looking clear drinks that just can't be water, and wearing black velvet and swagging silk and high heel shoes and stockings with little glittering things on them. Every man in the pictures is as handsome as the handsomest man you ever saw, and they're all gazing longingly through horn-rimmed glasses into the eyes of the sultry-looking women whose split skirts fall open to reveal that the little glittering things go all the way up. There's a hint of mystery and intrigue, and the implication that under the spell of these wonderful clothes and the magic of midwinter, transformations will occur. Little niggling flirtations that have been going on all year will blossom, and ordinary people will be changed into the gorgeous creatures we see in the glossy pictures. I have never been to a party like that. We do have a Christmas party at the school where I teach. We have it in the teacher workroom on the last day of school after the children have gone home. The food is all left over from the classroom Christmas parties. Cupcakes with Santa Claus's face drawn on the top. Little wreaths made out of Rice Krispies gummed up with melted marshmallows and dyed green with food coloring. And Hawaiian punch at room temperature. Everyone silently avoids certain things. Those gingerbread boys came from Mrs. Robinson's class. Her room mother smokes in the kitchen, and there's always an ashtray flavor lurking behind the ginger and nutmeg. We are all dressed for Christmas, certainly, but it's not the same as in the magazine. Mrs. Johnson is wearing her Santa Claus pin, the one where you pull the string and his nose lights up, and Miss Meadows is wearing a sweatshirt she painted herself. She smeared one of Santa's boots, but she turned the smear into a reindeer. I always wear my red corduroy jumper on that last day and red socks. No one tries the glittering stockings. The children will just pick all the glitter off at story time. We all sit around the paper cutter and the broken chairs that are stored in the teacher workroom and put our plates and cups where we can. The secret Santas are revealed. I had drawn Mrs. Jones's name, and I'd been secretly giving her little presents all month. I knew it was you, she says. I recognized your writing. But I disguised my writing, I wail. You disguised it that same way last year, she says. I wasn't surprised to learn that Mrs. Sampson was the one who'd given me the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer embroidered dish towel. I know her stitching. Mr. Dale, the media specialist, is the only man at our Christmas party. For the past 15 years, I've had a little crush on Mr. Dale. There's something so comforting about the way he comes into our darkened classroom when I can't get the movie projector to work. He flips open a little door on the side of the machine I didn't even know was there, reaches inside, clicks little levers, snaps things into place. Then suddenly the big reels begin to turn. We hear Dixie. There's the seal of the state of Georgia on the screen, and the movie begins. "There you are," says Mr. Dale reassuringly, and then he's gone. But poor old Mr. Dale is so tired from reshelving books all day and running around with new film strip projector bulbs. And I'm a little dizzy from the effort of keeping my class under control this week when they've got more red dye than blood in their veins. After a while, Miss Meadows spills Hawaiian punch down the front of her sweatshirt, and Mrs. Johnson's Santa Claus nose won't stop blinking. Even Mr. Dale can't make it stop. "Somebody pulled the string too hard," he says. Finally, we say goodbye and have a Merry Christmas to each other, gather up our things, and go home. I hang my Rudolph dish towel on the rack in the kitchen and put my feet up. Somebody pulled the elastic out of my socks at story time, and they're drooping around my ankles. I imagine Mr. Dale at home lying flat on his back with an ice pack on his head. Every time I close my eyes, I see Santa Claus's nose blinking. "Next year," I tell myself. "Next year I'll get those glittery stockings."
Commentator Bailey White was a longtime school teacher in her hometown, Thomasville, Georgia. She's published two essay collections and a novel. That commentary aired on All Things Considered in 1991. While the office Christmas party always generates lots of buzz, commentator John McElraith would rather focus on one of the unspoken yet most pleasurable traditions of his holiday season.
Every decent adult knows there are things you do that children mustn't see, practices that can only be indulged when adults are alone. Children never understand that Mommy and Daddy have things to do by themselves. That is the time when the bedroom door is locked, maybe even the living room door. That's all right in theory, but our bedroom lock has never worked. And there's no lock on the living room door. What to do, what to do. We had to be alone. Every couple has traditions. There are things that are done every Sunday or Saturday or every Easter or Christmas. So we settle down in the garage. It has a door that locks, but we hear them out there. Mummy, Daddy, are you in there? What are you doing in there? Open the door. They are all shouting now. The neighbors will hear. We give in. We open the door. The kids surround us. What were you doing in there? There's a touch of fear in their voices. We say nothing. Just talking. That's all. We gather them together and go back into the house. I look at my wife in despair. She shrugs. It's all right for her, but I can't wait much longer. I know. We'll turn on the TV and settle them down that way. It's a nice Christmas Eve show. Soon they are engrossed, all three of them, the two boys lying down and their sister sitting on a chair. I smile towards my wife. God, she's looking beautiful. In profile, I see the long column of her neck stretching up and her blonde hair lying on her cheeks, which have such a beautiful color tonight. I'm a lucky man. Now, if I can only get her alone as I do every Christmas Eve. We turn and look at one another. We exchange glances. She nods towards the door. Quietly, I rise. And slowly and soundlessly, I take a step. Where are you going, Daddy? Nowhere. Just into the kitchen. I make it to the door, close it behind me, and stand there, barely breathing. A minute goes by, and another minute. Where is she? Doesn't she understand how much I need her? The door opens, and silently, she steps into the kitchen. I put my arms around her. Where can we go? She asks. Her voice is husky. The linen closet. I answer. She whispers back. We have never done it in there before. Will there be room? We are in the linen closet. It is dark, but we have done this so often, we don't need light. Here's Gordon's stocking. Put the orange and the apple in first and put the pocket knife on top of the fruit. I have written the labels for the bikes and the dolls. Now, who did we decide gets the teddy bear? I don't remember. This business of wrapping the Christmas presents drives me crazy every year. Do you think they know what we are trying to do?
From 1990, that was writer John McElwraith. His commentaries appeared on All Things Considered for more than 10 years. He died in 2006. At this darkest time of year, hope can sometimes be hard to find. Storyteller Jay O'Callaghan remembers a midwinter when his most fervent hopes centered on a little boy.
On Christmas Eve, my sisters and I would run across to the Grahams, and I would turn in the middle of the street, and I'd look at our house, and it took my breath away. It would be all dark, and there'd be a white candle burning in every window. Then Dr. Graham would take us Christmas caroling all over the neighborhood, and we loved that. Dr. Graham, he ran the Faulkner Hospital in Jamaica Plain, and he worked 7 days a week till about 10 o'clock at night, but he'd get home a couple of days before Christmas Eve to rehearse us. We had those John Hancock Insurance Company booklets, and Dr. Graham would bend over and conduct us with his hands and his eyes. We'd have to sing very quietly, Venite Adore. Then he would stand up a little straighter, Venite Adore. Then he would stand all the way up, Venite Adore. We felt so important. Well, then came the Christmas Eve when everything was different. My mother was tired. She didn't have her bounce and energy. All that day, she was tired. She had come home from the hospital the day before, and she'd had a baby, Christopher. I had three sisters. Well, now I had a baby brother, Christopher. He had this huge name, Christopher. I could almost see him with his diapers carrying the car home. Christopher's home. Well, Christopher didn't come home. Something was wrong with his heart, and Mother was worried, and the day got late, and Daddy was shopping with Uncle Neil, and that meant they might come home festive. The phone rang, and Mummy picked it up, and the doctor said, The baby's dying. There's nothing I can do. And he hung up. Well, Daddy came home and he was furious when he heard that. He called the hospital and said, "That's no way to tell someone that child is dying. We'll be right down." We went to the hospital and I said to my sister Maureen, "Look at that blue baby." And Maureen said, "That's Christopher." A doctor came and he said to Daddy, "I think we've made a mistake on the blood tests. There's a new procedure, and what we can do is change the blood, and there's a chance we'll know in a day or two." Came home and I never saw Mummy so tired, so exhausted. Daddy took her up the big front stairs and down into her room. He was coming out of her room and it was all dark, and he turned and he said to Mom, "Helen, just get some sleep. It'll be all right." He shut the door and saw her standing in the hall. He said, "We'll just hope for the best. There's nothing you can do, so go Christmas caroling." So we ran across the street to the Grahams, and I turned, and we had forgotten. The whole house was blazing with electric lights. Even Maureen forgot to put a candle in every window. Dr. Graham, he took all of us down to the bottom of the hill to the free hospital for women. We went up to a ward, and there must have been 60 old women in a ward in their beds, and we sang for them, and I was thinking, I hope Mummy's asleep. Dr. Graham took us all over the neighborhood. He always knew who was sick and hurt and sad. It took 2 hours, and we had finished. We were walking over the hill, and I think we saw it all at once. We looked up, and our whole house was dark. But there was a white candle burning in every window. And Maureen said, "I hope Mummy's asleep." And Dr. Graham said, "We're going to sing a carol for your mother." And we did something we'd never done. We didn't go to the front door. We went around to the side of the house, and we sang up towards Mother's window, the first Noel. And her window was all black except for that candle that was burning. And all of a sudden, Mother appeared in that window, and she looked like an angel. We had cocoa, and we all went to sleep, not knowing whether Christopher would live or die. 10 years later, we had finished Christmas caroling, and we were coming over the hill. Dr. Graham, he laughed and said, "One more carol." It was a tradition now. We all sang underneath Mother's window to finish. So we sang once again under her window. It was all dark except for the white candle. We sang the first Noel, and Mother appeared again. And as we sang, my sister Maureen, my older sister, was crying. And I was thinking, well, she just got married 3 weeks ago, and she was going to Chicago for her married life. This is the last time she'd be with us. And I whispered, "Chicago'll be fine." She shook her head. It wasn't that. And then I realized she was crying because she was standing beside Christopher. He was 10 years old.
Storyteller Jay O'Callaghan spends his Christmases in Marshfield, Massachusetts. He told that story on All Things Considered in 1995. You're listening to Tinsel Tales, Stories of the Season from the NPR Archives. I'm Lynn Neary, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org.
Welcome back to Tinsel Tales, stories of the season from NPR. I'm Lynn Neary.
Lord and Taylor. Ann Taylor, Ann Klein, Calvin Klein, Cuisinart, Kmart, Kodak, cotton polyester, budget stretcher, store-wide half-off. Fry Daddy, Bugle Boy, Mr. Coffee, Sam Goody, Alan Solly, Polypro-Plastic Snow, Plastic Trees, two IDs, all sales final, simulated wood grain vinyl. UPS, JVC, PC, CD, GE, GI Joe, IJ Fox, TJ Maxx, Fax, Pentax, Woofer, Tweeter, Quartz Heater. Nintendo, Mario, Hasbro, Tyco, Tonka, Dolby, Barbie, B. Dalton, J. Crew, iZod, Turtlenecks, Polynex, Amex, Gore-Tex, Memorex, Magnavox, Tyson Socks, Reeboks, Jean-Tout, Jeanette, Cachet, Fabergé, Automatic Layaway, Duracell, EverReady, Cable Ready, Rechargeable, Returnable, Portable, Digital, Trivial Pursuit. Waterproof, Ovenproof, Shockproof, 90-proof, Helder Skelter, Alka-Seltzer, Carphone, Brookstone, Stonewashed, Dot Matrix, Cotton Dockers. Analog, London Fog, Canadian Club, Scotch Tape, Irish Mist, English Leather, British Sterling, Sterling Silver, Lady Schick, Sure Stick, Nonstick, Waterpik, Shreve Crump, Low Watt, Crock Pot. Jim Beam, Jeffrey Bean, On Screen, Microscreen, Multifunction, Autofocus, Flying Erase, Liquid Crystal, Letter Quality, Freshness Dated, Prefaded, Gold Plate, Tinselate, Air Freight, Solid State, Mutant, Turtles. One Step, Two Lux, Three Speed, Four Slice, Saks Fifth Ave, Six Pack, Seagram 7, High 8, 9 Volt, 10 Speed, 12 Cup, 14 Day, 40 Channel, 1-800. White Balance, Infrared, Stanley Blacker, Black & Decker, Spelling Checker, What the Heck, Deck the Halls with Hitachi, Mitsubishi, Sansui, Sony, Seiko, Sanyo, Panasonic, Ultrasonic, Instamatic, Automatic, Antistatic, Alkaline, 9-9, Kelvin, Klein, Ann, Klein, Ann, Taylor, Lord, and Taylor, good Lord. What have we done? To Christmas.
Ode to Christmas by Chuck Kramer, a tradition on NPR's Morning Edition for 20 years, and even longer than that on WCVB-TV in Boston, where Kramer was a reporter and commentator. When this story first aired on Morning Edition in 1992, it launched the literary career of humorist David Sedaris. Sedaris reads Santaland Diaries about his earlier, less successful career at Macy's department store in New York City.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa!" Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. "22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting in magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, 'Which is the line for the women's bathroom?' And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. She said, 'I'm going to have you fired.' I had two people say that to me today. 'I'm going to have you fired.' Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? I'm going to have you fired, and I want to lean over and say, 'I'm going to have you killed.'" The overall cutest elf is a fella from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, this flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden, we were surrounded by 5 Santas and 3 other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on. Elves and Santas. Today, a child told Santa that he wanted his dead father back and a complete set of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Everyone loves those turtles. A child came to Santa this morning, and his mother said, "All right, Jason. All right, tell Santa what you want. Tell him what you want." Jason said, "I want Procter and Gamble to stop animal testing." The mother said, "Procter, Jason, that's Procter and Gamble. And what do they do to animals? Do they torture animals, Jason? Is that what they do?" Jason said, "Yes, they torture." He was maybe 6 years old. This morning I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, "This way out of Santa Land." A woman was standing at one of the cash registers, paying for her pictures while her son lay beneath her, kicking and heaving, having a tantrum. The woman said, "Riley, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for." The child said, "He is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me." The woman grabbed my arm and said, "You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas." I said that Santa changed his policy and no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. All your appliances, Riley, including the refrigerator. Your food is going to spoil and smell bad. You're going to wish you never even heard the name Santa. The woman got a worried look on her face and said, "All right, that's enough." I said, "He's going to take your car and your furniture and all of your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing." The mother said, "No, that's enough. Really." This afternoon I was stuck being photo elf with Santa. During most days there's a slow period when you sit around the house and talk to Santa. And most of them are nice guys and we sit around and laugh. But Santa takes himself a bit too seriously. I asked him where he lives, Brooklyn or Manhattan, and he said, "Why, I live at the North Pole with Mrs. Claus." I asked what he does the rest of the year, and he said, "I make toys for all the children." He actually recited "The Night Before Christmas," and it was just the two of us in the house. No children, just us. He says, "Oh, little elf, straighten up those mantle toys for Santa." I reminded him that I have a name, Crumpet, and then I straightened up the stuffed animals. Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He'll talk to them and give a hearty chuckle and ring his bells, and then he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol. Santa then asks if they'll sing it for him. The children are shy and don't want to sing out loud, so Santa says, "Oh, little elf, help young Brenda here sing that favorite carol of hers." Late in the afternoon, a child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was. Santa suggested "Away in a Manger." The girl agreed to it but didn't want to sing because she didn't know the words. Santa said, "Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us." It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I sang it the way Billie Holiday might have sang if she'd put out a Christmas album. "Away in a manger, no crib for a bed.
the little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head.
Santa did not allow me to finish. This evening I was sent to be a photo elf. Once a child starts crying, it's all over. The parents had planned to send these pictures as cards or store them away until the child is grown and can lie, claiming to remember the experience. Tonight I saw a woman slap and shake her crying child. She yelled, "Rachel, get on that man's lap and smile or I'll give you something to cry about." Then she sat Rachel on Santa's lap and I took the picture, which supposedly means, on paper, that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be, that everything is snowy and wonderful. It's not about the child or Santa or Christmas or anything, but the parents' idea of a world they cannot make work for them.
Santaland Diaries, read by David Sedaris. The story was produced for radio by Ira Glass and was first broadcast on NPR's Morning Edition in 1992. It's included in Sedaris' book, Barrel Fever. You're listening to Tinsel Tales, Stories of the Season from NPR. The story of the first Christmas, 2 centuries ago, describes Joseph and Mary on a cold night traveling the road to Bethlehem. They took refuge in a stable because there was no room for them in a nearby inn. On the first Christmas Eve after Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast, NPR Scott Simon imagined another setting for the story.
Joseph and Mary hitchhiked to a shelter next to a Walmart in Pas Christian, Mississippi. They'd lost their home in a hurricane, and the trailer that FEMA had promised wasn't ready. Joseph was a carpenter, and there was lots of work in the area. But he and Mary had no place to live, and Mary was pregnant. She told Joseph that he would be the child's father, but he wasn't the child's father. The spark that began the life of their child, she said, came from, well, it was too embarrassing for Joseph to repeat. It sounded impossible and ridiculous. Friends told him he was being taken for a fool, but Joseph loved Mary. He knew that the last few months had been hard for her. Joseph decided that whatever fantastic stories Mary told him, he would love the child as his own. When Joseph and Mary got to Pas Christian, they were told there was no room at the shelter. But a kindly man said they could unroll their blankets on the floor of his garage next door. The garage was cold, he said, but it had a wireless internet connection. That night, Mary had a baby boy. He seemed healthy, wrinkly, and had a nice loud cry. Mary laid their baby down on the back of a hybrid car that was under repair, swaddled in the one denim jacket Joseph was able to take when they fled their house. Mary lay down in the front seat. Joseph rolled down the windows. A stray gray dog, still grimy from the road and whimpering with loneliness, kept watch over the baby and helped keep him warm with her panting. Joseph also plugged his iPod into a set of speakers so their baby could be lulled to sleep with music. That night a star appeared in the east. Actually, quite a few stars, but Bill Gates noticed one in particular and sent 5 wise people, the group recently expanded from 3 wise men, to Pas Christian to see Joseph and Mary's child. Bono, William Sapphire, Monica Ali, Aung San Suu Kyi, and Henry Louis Gates, no relation, all wanted to bring the child gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But they hadn't been available since the hurricane. So the wise people brought chipotle lime taco chips, chocolate chip cheesecake, and asparagus for fiber. The infant saw them and smiled. Mary saw the look of delight in her child's face and said to herself, "He's happy to be in this world. He's happy to be with us." But she saw Joseph sitting off by himself at the far end of the garage. She knew he was worried about how he was going to make a life for their child. When Joseph came back to the car, his eyes glimmered. "I think I finally understand," he said, "why we're here, why we've been given the gift of this child. It doesn't matter who the father is, does it? Every child born cries for our love and deserves our care. Every child who's hungry in Sudan or Louisiana or Indonesia, every little girl who's abandoned by a roadside in China, every little boy in Uganda who's dragged into somebody's army while he's still not as tall as the gun they put in his arms, Every teenager who never seems to take off their earbuds. Every little boy and girl anywhere who's threatened by a bomb, an epidemic, a bullet, or a storm. I must love them as a father loves his child. Mary and Joseph sat with their arms around each other and around their baby boy. The dog, they decided to adopt her on the spot, hopped up in the seat beside them and put her head gently onto Joseph's lap. The star that had found them seemed to stay above them for a moment, while their child breathed softly, safely, peacefully in their arms, looking out at a world that seemed suddenly new.
NPR's Scott Simon from a broadcast of Weekend Edition in December of 2005. When NPR was getting its start in the early 1970s, a Texan named John Henry Falk soon became a favorite commentator. Falk was a writer, a radio broadcaster who'd been blacklisted in the 50s, and a gifted storyteller. John Henry Falk recorded this Christmas story in 1974 for the NPR program Voices in the Wind.
The day after Christmas, a number of years ago, I was driving down a country road in Texas, and it was a bitter cold, cold morning, and walking ahead of me on the gravel road was a little barefooted boy with nondescript ragged overalls and a makeshift sleeve of a sweater tied around his little ears. I stopped and picked him up. He looked like he was about 12 years old, and his little feet were blue with the cold. He's carrying an orange. And he got in and had the brightest blue eyes one ever saw, and he turned a bright smile on my face and says, "I'm going down the road about 2 miles to my cousin's. I want to show him my orange old Sandy Claus brought me." Well, I wasn't going to mention Christmas to him because I figured he came from a family that kind of don't have Christmas. But he brought it up himself. He said, "Did old Sandy Claus come to see you, mister?" And I said, "Yes, we had a real nice Christmas at our house, and I hope you had the same." He paused for a moment, looked at me, and then with all the sincerity in the world said, "Mister, we had the wonderfulest Christmas in the new 9 states down to our place. Lordy, it was the first one we ever had there. See, we never do have them out there much. Don't notice when Christmas time comes. We'd heard about it, but never did have one because, well, you know, it's just, Papa says old Sandy Claus, Papa hoorahs a lot, said old Sandy Claus was scared to bring his reindeer down into our section of the county because folks down there are so hard up that they liable to catch one of his reindeer and butcher him for meat. But just several days before Christmas, a lady come out from town and she told all the families through there, our family too, that there was old Sandy Claus was coming town to leave some things for us, and if Papa'd go in town, he could get some Christmas time for all of us. And Papa hooked up the mule wagon. He went in town, but he told us children, said, now don't y'all get all worked up and excited because there might not be nothing to this yarn that lady told. But shucks, he hadn't got out of sight up the lane there. We was done watching for him to come back, and we couldn't get our minds on nothing else, you know. And Mama, she'd come door every once in a while and say, now y'all quit that looking up the lane because Papa told you there might not be nothing. But long about the middle of the afternoon, well, we heard the team of jangling harness coming, and we ran out in the front yard, and Ernie, my little brother, called out, said, yonder come Papa, and here come them mules just in a big trot, you know, and Papa standing upright in the bed of that wagon holding two big old chickens, all feathers picked off, and he was just yelling, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, and the team stopped right in front of the gate, and all us children just went swarming out there like a flock of chee-chees, you know, and just crawling over that wagon and looking in. And, mister, I wished you could have seen what was in that wagon. his bags of stripedy candy and apples and oranges and sacks of flour and some real coffee, you know, and just all tensely and pretty. And we couldn't say nothing, just kind of held our breath and looked at it, you know, and Papa standing there just waving them two chickens and yelling, Merry Christmas to you, Merry Christmas to you, and a laughing, that big old grin on his face. And Mama, she come a-hurrying out with the baby in her arms, you know, and when she looked in that wagon, she just stopped, and then Papa, he dropped them two chickens and retched and caught the baby out of her arms, you know, and held him up and said, Merry Christmas to you, Sandy Claus, and baby little old Alvy Lee, he just laughed like he knowed it was Christmas too, you know. And Mama, she started telling us to name all of them nuts. They wasn't just peanuts. She had names for all of them. Mama knows a heap of things like that. She'd seen that stuff before, you know. And we was all of us just a-chattering and a-going on at the same time, us young'uns are looking in there. And all of a sudden, we heard Papa call out, Merry Christmas to you, Sam Jackson. And we stopped and looked, and here comes Sam Jackson leading that old cripple leg mule of his up the lane. And Papa said, Sam Jackson, did you get in town to get some Christmas this year? Sam Jackson, you know, he sharecrops over there across the creek from our place. And he shook his head and said, well, no, sir, Mr. Will, I didn't go in town. I heard about that, but I didn't know it was for colored folks, too. I thought it was just for you white families. All of a sudden, none of us children were saying nothing. Papa, he looked down at Mama. And Mama looked up at him, and they didn't say nothing like they don't a heap of times, but they know what the others are thinking. They're like that, you know. And all of a sudden, Papa, he broke out in a big grin again. He said, Dad, blame it, Sam Jackson, it's sure a good thing you come by here. Lord have mercy, I like to forgot. Old Sandy Claus would have me in court if he'd heard about this. The last thing he asked me if I lived out here near you. Said he hadn't seen you around and said he wanted me to bring part of this out here to you and your family, your woman and your children. Well, sir, Sam Jackson, he broke out in a big grin. And Papa said, I'll tell you what to do. You get your wife and children and you come down here tomorrow morning. It's going to be Christmas time all day long. Come early and stay late. And Sam Jackson said, you reckon? And Mama called out to him and said, yes, and you tell your wife to be sure and bring some pots and pans because we're going to have a heap of cooking to do, and I ain't sure I've got enough to take care of all of it. Well, sir, old Sam Jackson, he started off leading that mule up lane in a full trot, you know, and he's heading home to get the word to his folks and his children, you know. And next morning, it just, you remember how it was yesterday morning? Just rosy red and looked like Christmas time. It's cold, but you didn't notice the cold, you know, and the sun just come up, just all rosy red, and us young'uns were all out of bed before daylight, seemed like, just running in the kitchen and smelling and looking, and it was all there, sure enough. And here comes Sam Jackson and his team and his wife and his five young'uns in there, and it's all looking over the edge, and we run out and yell, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, and Papa said, Christmas gift to you, Sam Jackson. Y'all come on in. And they come in, and Mama and Sister Jackson, they got in the kitchen, and they started cooking things up. And us young'uns started playing Christmas time. And it's a lot of fun, you know. We just play Christmas gift with one another and run around the house and just roll in the dirt, you know. And then we started playing go up to the kitchen door and smell. And we'd run up and smell inside that kitchen door where Mama and Sister Jackson was cooking at, and then we'd just die laughing and roll in the dirt, you know, and go chasing around and playing Christmas gift. And we played Christmas time till we just wore ourselves out. And Papa and Sam Jackson, they'd put a table up and put some sheets over it, some boards up over some sawhorses. And everybody had a place, even the baby. And Mama and Sister Jackson said, well, now it's ready to come on in, we're going to have Christmas dinner. And I sit right next to Willie Jackson, you know, and he'd just roll his eyes at me, and I'd roll mine. We'd just die laughing, you know, and there was an apple and an orange and some stripedy candy at everybody's place, and that was just dessert. See, that wasn't a real Christmas dinner. Mama and them had done cooked that up, and they just had it spread up and down the table. And so Papa and Sam Jackson, they'd been sitting on the front porch, and they come in. Papa, he sit at one end of the table, and Sam Jackson said it the other, and it was just a beautiful table like you never had seen. And I didn't know nothing could ever look like that and smell that good, you know. And Sam Jackson, you know, he's real black, and he had on that white clean shirt of his and in them overhauls. Everything had been washed and was real clean. Papa, he said, "Brother Jackson, I believe you're a deacon in the church. I ain't much of a church man myself, but I believe you're a deacon. Maybe you'd be willing to give grace." Well, Sam Jackson, he stood up there, and his hands was real big, and he kind of held on to the side of that table, you know. But he didn't bow his head like a heap of folks do when they're saying blessing. He just looked up and smiled. And he said, "Lord, I hope you having as nice a Christmas up there with your angels as we have it down here. Because it's sure is Christmas time down here. And I just wanted to say, Merry Christmas to you, Lord." Like I say, mister, I believe that was the wonderfulest Christmas in the new 9 states of America.
Commentator John Henry Falk recorded that story for NPR in 1974. Falk died in 1990 in his hometown of Austin, Texas. You've been listening to Tinsel Tales, a collection of Christmas stories from the NPR archives. You can find these and other stories of the season at npr.org/holidays. Tinsel Tales was produced by Saraya Muhammad and edited by Don Lee. Special thanks to Eric Newsom and Anya Grundman. I'm Lynn Neary. And as Charles Dickens said in A Christmas Carol, "I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year."
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org, and from the Music Performance Fund, striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of free concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Join us today at noon for our traditional broadcast of Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol. Professor Landis read Dickens' classic story every year to UIUC students, and while he's no longer with us, the tradition continues thanks to this recording. That's today at noon, Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol, here on AM 580, WILL Urbana. Merry Christmas.
Thanks for listening to AM 580. I'm Henry Frayne with a check of your Christmas Day forecast. Today mostly sunny, not as cold, highs in the lower 40s, south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight mostly cloudy, lows